I say we thought the best approach was if it looks like we're making progress, we keep working, and if that means a couple of the issues at the end of the day tomorrow don't get talked about, well, that's just life. So, Mr. Patrick.
Yes, good morning. We move on to paper two, on variable payments for the separate acquisition of assets. At the September meeting, the committee directed the staff to prepare a paper that would present the different models discussed so far for the accounting for variable payments. The committee also directed the staff to address the accounting for the debit side of the transaction. So in order to meet those objectives, the paper discusses the requirements in the current IFRSs, the requirements in IFRS 3 on contingent consideration, and the tentative decisions taken so far by the boards in the leases project. The paper discusses both the initial accounting and the subsequent accounting because we think that the two issues are linked and should be addressed together. The second part of the paper deals with subsequent accounting and focuses on the accounting for the debit side of the transaction. So, following our analysis, we think that the committee has two alternatives regarding the initial accounting. Alternative one, as presented in the paper, is to include the fair value of all variable payments in the initial measurement of the liability. Alternative two is to exclude variable payments that are dependent on the purchaser's future activity from the initial measurement of the liability. The basis for alternative one would be to consider that the purchaser has an obligation on the date of purchase of the asset to pay the variable payments. The basis for alternative two would be to consider that the purchaser does not have an obligation to pay those variable payments that are dependent on the purchaser's future activity until the activity is performed. Another basis for alternative two is that to require the recognition of a liability on the date of purchase of the asset for variable payments that are dependent on the purchaser's future activity is or might be considered too complex and would not provide sufficiently useful information to users to outweigh the cost. We support alternative two. We think that the reasons put forward by the boards in the leases project to exclude certain variable payments from the initial measurement of the liability are also valid within the context of the separate acquisition of assets. For example, a 20-year service concession arrangement might specify that an operator has a right to charge users of the public service in exchange for payments made to the grantor based on future revenues, for example. And in that case, to require the recognition of a liability that includes the variable payments to be made over a 20-year period might be considered too complex. We do not think that the accounting for contingent consideration in a business combination is appropriate for that situation. Business combinations, in our views, are one-off discrete transactions. Contingent considerations in a business combination are typically paid within the next or two or three years following the business combination. Acquisition of assets are, in our view, common transactions, and we are talking about variable payments that could be made over a very long period in long-term contracts, as in leases. So, as mentioned in the paper, we do not think that the committee should deal with this through an interpretation. If the committee can reach a consensus, we think that this issue should rather be addressed through proposed amendments to current IFRSs as part of a narrow scope project. So our first question to the committee is the following. Does the committee agree with alternative one, the fair value of all variable payments should be included in the initial measurement of the liability on the date of purchase of the asset? Or alternative two, variable payments that are dependent on the purchaser's future activity should be excluded from the initial measurement of the liability until the activity is performed?
Laurence?
I express support for alternative two. as the staff recommends.
Others?
I also in the intention of alternative two, but it's like a little bit unclear that the basis for the staff view is for the non-recognition rely on the obligation being contingent or the complexity of the measurement.
In other words, which of the two arguments did you find persuasive, Patrick?
Well, in the paper, we focused on the complexity.
Guido? Then Charlotte, then Andrew.
Okay, so I'm also in favor of alternative two. I'm although still struggling with the arguments in the paper. I understand that if it depends on the purchaser's future activities, and maybe the problem that I have is to understand what you mean by this. You give some examples in the paper that say, well, if it's a certain percentage of the sales or a milestone. So I do understand that because it's really based on the activity of the purchaser, and he can avoid making the payment. He or she can make can avoid making the payment by not selling it. On the other hand, we have in IS 32 something that you also mentioned, which says as long as it's based on revenue, that's beyond the control of both of the parties. No, I'm a bit struggling. You know, that's really. So would you say that if it's based on revenue, it's not dependent on the purchaser's future activity? I could say yes, it is, because it's the same thing as being based on a certain percentage of sales. So that's where I'm struggling with. I agree with alternative two, mm-hmm. but I don't think the argument could be it's too complex to make the calculations. If I understood you correctly, that's your main argument.
Well, because it's difficult to conclude on the other argument whether there is an obligation or not, because there are conflicting guidance. As you mentioned, there is IS 32. Although some might say that IS 32 should not apply to acquisition of assets because it was not intended to apply to those situations but to other situations. You have IFRS 3 that clearly, I think, concludes that in the case of a business combination, you would include all those viable payments that are based on revenues in the initial measurement of the liability. And on the other hand, you have the leases project that would, for mixed reasons, conclude that you would exclude certain viable payments, such as payments based on revenues from the initial measurement. So that's why maybe in the paper we do not conclude, because there is conflicting guidance on a conceptual point of view, whether there is an obligation or not. And that we still think that in cases for acquisition of assets, it would make sense to exclude certain viable payments from the initial measurement because it might be considered too complex to do that for very long contracts such as 20-year service concession arrangement, where you would be required to estimate if the payments are based on revenues, all the viable payments on the next 20-year period. And we think that this is exactly why in the leases project the board came to that conclusion to exclude some of the viable payments. I don't want to speak for the board, but this is what we think, what we understand from the project.
But maybe to answer to that, I agree with you on IFRS 3, because if I look at the basis of conclusions and the reasons why they accounted for contingent considerations. Got it. exposure draft to the ED of ICE 37 anyway. The reason why I'm not, well, I agree with you that there are different, there seems to be different guidance in the standards. I was thinking about, the way I would like to see that is that I think that 39 or 32 tells you in the application guidance to charge changes in the liability to P&L. And I agree with you, you brought some examples, very good examples, IFRIC 1 or ICE 23 that say, well, there may be standards that require different accounting to be at that part of the acquisition cost. I think that that's the main argument. And you could come up with this argument even though you would recognize also variable payments in the initial recognition of the liability. So also changes in the initial recognition of the liability, from my point of view, could be acquisition costs and not interest expense. I understand that you took a different way here and say, well, if you initially recognize the variable payments, all changes go through P&L. I'm not convinced that that is the right answer. But anyway, so I don't know whether maybe we should consider both questions at the same time, because as you said, they are interrelated. So my point of view, you could come up with recognizing the variable payments at the initial recognition, especially when it's revenue-based, because IS 32 seems to tell you that you should recognize it. The main question for me is, do you recognize it as part of the acquisition cost, or does it go through P&L?
Okay, before I scrambled the system, I had Charlotte, Andrew, Scott, John.
Okay, I would support alternative one. I thought the theoretical arguments in that were just not refuted in the discussion of alternative two, which seemed to be based on it's very complicated, so people shouldn't have to do it. And I would imagine that if somebody's purchasing an asset and having these sort of variable payments, they should be able to assess what the likely cost of those is. So I wouldn't really want someone to do that without thinking about it. I think, to me, the obligating event is the entering into the purchase contract, which is consistent with 32 and with IFRS 3. And I do think there's some grayness. I think the paragraph you quote cite from 32, paragraph 25, which states that revenues are aren't something that can be avoided, seems a little odd to me. That I think there would be times when there will be variable payments which don't necessarily trigger a financial liability. And I think that's the area that should be looked at, though I would agree with Guido that it's what you do subsequently that the question is, really.
Andrew?
Well, I just had a similar question to Guido, actually. I mean, I like the way the paper's drafted and is going, but I wondered to what extent the concept of control was incorporated into your thinking. But I think you're telling me that's too difficult, and that's what I heard a few minutes ago. I might have misunderstood. And I'm not sure I have too much of an issue with that, because we've been talking for this subject for ages, and it seems to me in order to get a sensible answer, we're going to have to break some of the constraints around existing standards. But I think that's what you're saying about control. You don't want to focus on the control thing, you just want about future activities. Is that right?
Scott?
My inclination is to follow exactly whatever the answer is in leases. Not because I necessarily think alternative two is a better answer than alternative one. I think Charlotte's probably right. Conceptually, alternative one feels better. But the board has spent a lot more time dealing with this issue than we can, despite the ages that we have spent talking about it. And I don't see the issue as being sufficiently different, variable payments in a lease versus variable payments in a purchase, that we ought to get different answers. So I would follow what the board does in leases, and so far that looks like it's alternative two. The only thing that I'd think about incrementally is if there are arrangements, types of arrangements with variable payments that you might see in a purchase that you wouldn't see in a lease, that might present some different issues. One example I can think of is in a lease, when you have sales-based payments, they typically go for the entire term of a lease. in a purchase, for example, the purchase of intellectual property, you will often have a royalty-like payment that is capped at some point. And once you have hit the cap, you still own the asset, but you don't make any further payments. Seems like that might be an issue that comes up in purchases that doesn't come up in leases and may not have been considered by the boards. But that's the only incremental types of things that I'd want to consider. Other than that, I'd just follow what the board does in leases.
John?
Well, I was reflecting on what we're trying to do here, and for variable payments, we have the general rules, I think, that are in IAS 32. Then we have specialized rules for business acquisition, and then we said in the business acquisition, you have special rules, defined special rules. In the lease project, then we come up with special rules for lease project here. I think we want to introduce special rules for acquisition of an asset. And for me, it's especially if you think of a group of assets, which is very close to an acquisition of a business, it's not obvious that I would look at leases. I think I would rather look at IFRS 3 as the rules. So it's not obvious that we need a special rules. We could follow the rules of 32 or IFRS 3 to record the liability and go with it. I thought that the real issue was in a cost model, what do you do with reevaluation of the liability? And unlike IFRS 3 situation, which once you made your acquisition, you're in a fair value model, any subsequent adjustment goes to P&L. In a cost model, well, the question is, well, you know, I pay more later on. Is it a cost? And I think that was initially the question. And here, it was not obvious to me that we should go to the lease. I've heard something this morning that indicates why. I didn't see that in the paper. Why you believe that the lease has something to do with acquisition of under IS 16 of capital asset? Because you mentioned that often it's a long-term payments and it would be impracticable to us to measure the liability. It's not that obvious to me. If we want to extend the practical exemption of the lease project here, I think the case hasn't been made very clear. At least for me, it was not clear to me. So honestly, I think I'm not sure we should import special rules here. We should stick to the rules that we have. It's the theoretical answer. We should fair value the liability, record that, and deal with subsequent adjustment. That I agree with your proposal on the subsequent adjustment, that it should go to the cost. But for the initial recognition, I understand. I think we need to deal with that, but I'm not just totally certain of that. I would prefer not to deal with that. Or if we deal with accounting for variable payment, do we mean that the board should address accounting for variable payments in general when the variable payment depends on future performance? And that's not a question that is strictly related to acquisition of asset. If that's the case, then maybe it's a different topic, and maybe that's a valid question. Do we have a liability or not? It means revision of IS 32. It also means what do we do with IFRS 3, which states that you have a liability. And it's very large. So it's unclear to me what we're trying to do here in the context of acquisition of asset and dealing with a liability, but in a nutshell, just as it relates to this acquisition of asset. So the only way you can do that is by using a practical exemption. And I think you avoided saying whether there's a liability or not because of the conflicting rules. And the practical exemption might be valid. But if it's valid for that, it's valid for a lot of other situations, I believe. It's difficult to measure a viable liability. And why is it so much more difficult for this one? I'm not sure. I understand the lease project, though, because leases, you have volumes, you have large situation and you have long extending periods and, you know, that's my...
Hans?
Yeah, I just want to respond to Jean, comment on some comments Jean made. The first one about why is it important to tie it to lease? It is because when you purchase an intangible asset with variable payments, or when you enter into a lease in most of the cases is going to be payments for the right, you acquire a right to use an asset. And somehow, I know the ISB is not going to qualify this right, whether what it is, but in a sense it has many characteristics of an intangible asset. So having different treatments for leases or purchases of licenses with variable payments would create many distortions and complexities. So I completely support the views expressed by Scott and others that it is important to tie it to leases. Secondly, on your comment about the fact that this may be the issue of purchases with variable payments may be a cross-cutting issue to be looked at by the ISB comprehensively, I completely share your point. And so as to see throughout the literature, how is it dealt with? Is it normal that we may have a difference in treatments depending on the types of transactions? I do think that we always bounce in this type of issues depending on the type of transaction. At the moment, we have dealt with on a piecemeal basis. We are dealing with it on a piecemeal basis, but I do believe it warrants an overall view across the topics by the ISB at some stage. So I would completely support stepping up without saying, I'm not saying here that I would delay what is being done, but I do believe that at some stage, ISB should have a look throughout the standards and how do they deal with purchases with variable payments and to make sure that the whole thing ties up together.
John?
I mean, conceptually, I'm in alternative one. I'm not convinced that the obligating event is different between a business, acquiring a business and acquiring assets. So to me, the whole issue of differential rule on recognition of a liability seems to be somewhat fraught. I do think, though, that the issue is much broader. I mean, because I am, as Jean said, I mean, I'm concerned by creating different rules for liability recognition for different, you know, whether it's a lease transaction or whether it's an asset acquisition or an intangible acquisition or a business combination. So, and I certainly don't think that the solution to this is some narrow scope amendment, because the issue is far too pervasive across multiple number of standards. So, I mean, I would prefer that the issue be focused on what happens to the remeasurement rather than trying to answer the question about whether there's a liability on initial recognition, because I just don't think that's capable of being answered in the current, where we are currently, either by this committee, and it requires a lot more work to be done, presumably by the board.
Luca?
In general, I share the comments of John. From a conceptual point of view, in my opinion, the first view is more robust, because also if I look at the debit sides in general, I will prefer to have the recognition of the total cost of the assets and then to look at the effects in the liability sides. In any case, I think that's also coming out from this discussion, I agree with Jane that at a certain point we should collects all the different kinds of variable payments in order to avoid to create a patchwork of different rules in different standards, try to create a single concept on the basis of the recognition of this.
I would observe that, and board members, please beat me up if I get this wrong. Couple of observations about the leases project. One is we're talking about entities that have thousands. Think of Boots the Chemist, of retail leases, all of them with contingent payments based on sales. And so there is a practicality issue? Is it just not practicable to ask them to independently measure every one of those leaseholds? There were board members who said, well, no, it's not a liability. Individually, I find that argument hard to take if you believe that the lease liability is, in fact, a liability in the first, any of the liability is a liability. So just saying the contingent payments part aren't a liability, that I haven't been able to understand that one. In any event, what I'm hearing around the table, and Pat's going to beat me up now. So Pat, go ahead, and then I'll.
I was one of those board members that felt that the contingent payments shouldn't be considered in the lease obligation. And I believe that the definition of a liability can be read to exclude them. I think that when the lessor takes part of its payment in terms of contingent payment based on future performance of the lessee, it has, in a sense, provided the lessee with some sort of capital, and it is, in effect, participating in that business. But my primary reason was that a lessee enters into a lease, particularly with variable lease payments, to give it financial flexibility so that it can avoid those payments when that particular asset is not performing up to what it was expected to when they entered into the lease. And it seemed to me to include, at the inception of the lease, the expected contingent lease payments made that entity's obligations look exactly like the obligations of an entity who had fixed obligations. And to me, that wasn't representationally faithful, because they had much more flexibility if they had variable lease payments based on operations of that asset. And that was the reason why I excluded them.
I apologize. I didn't mean to take us into a discourse on the leasing standard. Because what I think I'm hearing is that the committee is pretty much split between view one and view two. But I think the committee is also taking, or several members are taking, the view that they're not absolutely certain that initial and subsequent are that closely linked, and that we can set aside initial and move directly to subsequent and perhaps answer that on a standalone basis and thus strike a blow for freedom. So let's try that. Patrick?
Okay. So the second part of the paper is all about the subsequent accounting. Our objective here is to discuss the accounting for the debit side of the transaction, and in doing so to consider whether there are circumstances in which the remeasurement of the liability should be capitalized. We think that the committee has the two following alternatives. Alternative A, the adjustment of the liability should always be recognized in profit or loss. Alternative B, the adjustment of the liability as described in paragraph AG8 of IS 39 should be recognized as a corresponding adjustment to the cost of the asset in certain circumstances. We support alternative B. We think that the adjustment of the liability in accordance with paragraph AG8 relates to the purchase transaction itself and is not an interest expense. We think that the requirements in IS 16 and IFRIC 1 suggest that this adjustment should be capitalized in the cost of the asset, either entirely when the adjustment is a change of estimate, or to the extent that it relates to future economic benefits when the adjustment is not a change of estimate. Maybe if variable payments are initially included in the measurement of the liability, I think that recognizing all the subsequent adjustment in P&L would presumably create a lot of volatility and would be difficult to understand for users. So I really think that the appropriate answer is to support alternative B in that case, especially if we don't conclude on the initial measurement. So our question to the committee is the following. Does the interpretation committee agree with alternative A? The adjustment of the liability as described in paragraph 88 should be recognized in profit or loss. Or alternative B, the adjustment of the liability as described in paragraph 88 should be recognized as a corresponding adjustment to the cost of the asset, entirely when the adjustment is a change of estimate, and to the extent that it relates to future economic benefits when the adjustment is not a change of estimate.
Andrew?
Well, definitely sympathetic to the debit going to the asset if it enhances the value of that asset. But I think it would be, so that's where I start from, but I wasn't quite sure how you would apply that to the three examples you've got in paragraph 7. Do I assume the one that 7A, where it's dependent on index or rate, would be P&L, and 7B and C would be cost of the asset? I think it would be helpful to kind of understand where you're coming from before.
Of course, I think if the committee can reach a consensus on this issue, we would bring back a paper with the illustrative examples.
Right. Well, I think that would be a good idea as well. Very good idea. But I just wondered, so as a matter of principle, I would be on two if it enhances the value of the asset. I just wasn't quite sure how you'd apply that to those three examples.
Okay, I have Lawrence and then Guido.
I'm in favor of alternative two, but not because I'm afraid of volatility being reflected in financial statements, but more because of the arguments you have developed in your paper about the fact that you capitalize into the cost of the asset, such as in IS 23.1 and so on, so in order to determine the cost of the asset. But I do have a couple of comments, though. The first one relates to paragraph 44. When you talk about non-financial variable that is specific to a party to the contract, while you say that the instrument does not meet the definition of a derivative. As you know here, this is an issue that the ISB has not resolved, nor IFRIC, but whether you separate or not separate. And there is diversity. It was acknowledged when we discussed the issue of adjustment to the GDP of Greece for the Greek government bonds. So my question, so first of all, the statement in that paragraph 44 is ignoring a view where you recognize derivatives separately. And then my question would be, so what do you do when you are in this case? So I would like to see in a further analysis with the changes, gains and losses, what do you do? Do they go as in P&L or do they go into the cost of the asset? I suppose it would go into P&L in this case. My second question relates to CPI. A CPI adjustment, I wasn't sure to understand in your analysis whether you included, whether you think AG 7 or AG 8 applies. If I understand correctly, normally for CPI, AG 7 applies. I would like to have confirmation that this is the case.
Well, the IFRIC already talked about this issue and did not conclude. So in a previous meeting, I don't know when it was, but several years ago, the committee discussed this issue and said that judgment should be applied to determine whether CPI is considered to be a floating rate instrument, in which case you would apply AG7, or it's whether it should be considered as not a floating rate instrument, and in that case you would apply AG8.
Okay, I thought that the practice has always been to consider it as a entering into AG7, but
I think the general practice today is to consider that most of CPI indexations are floating rate instruments, but I couldn't give any specific...
Because in your list of examples, that you're going to draft if we go there. I mean, CPI is a common indexation for the type of assets that we are looking at, so I think it would be helpful. My third comment relates to paragraph 60. 59 and 60. So 59, you explain that if variable payments are initially included into the measurement of the liability, the adjustment to the liability corresponds to a change in estimates, and so should be recognized prospectively as under IFRIC 1. And then you go on in paragraph 60 to say, if the variable payments are not initially included into the measurement of the liability, the adjustment of the liability does not correspond to a change in estimates. And I was wondering why wouldn't it be a change in estimate where the initial estimate would be zero and then it would change? Or is it implying that if it is not a change in estimate, that you are recognizing an additional asset? Is this implying that?
This is linked to the initial recognition of the liability. What I'm just saying is that, and again, it's our views, if you initially include all the variable payments in the measurement of the liability, then if you adjust the liability, it's a change of estimate in the cash flows of the liability. There's, I think, no question about that. But when you don't initially include certain variable payments in the initial measurement of the liability, then the first time that you recognize this part of the liability related to variable payments is when the payment is incurred or when the activity is performed. In that case, you didn't make any initial estimation of the cash flows.
Why couldn't that initial estimate be zero? That's my first point. And secondly, with that paragraph 60, I was wondering exactly what type. Again, I'd like to understand the type of things we are talking about. So I can think of purchases index on sales. So I assume that you wouldn't have included a liability initially for percentage of sales you're going to make, mm-hmm. correct? Usually those cases will be captured by what you explained in paragraph 60. And so then you have, when you recognize the liability, you have to make the estimate whether it relates to future economic benefits, in which case it would go to the cost of the asset, which I doubt it would be in case of based of sales. So it would go into P&L. That's my development of what you state in your paper. Other than those,
if the payment is related to the sales that you're making in the current period, then it would be, the adjustment would be recognized in P&L.
I think the point here that we have to keep in mind is we decided to decouple.
Yeah.
And this is an argument that's absolutely based on
following
from the conclusion to the first one, so I'm not sure we're going to gain a lot by pursuing this. I understand your confusion, Laurence, but I'm not sure now that we've decoupled the two that we need to keep pushing this string.
I think it's to make sure that people will understand what we are going to produce. that's.
I take your point, and in my simple-minded way of thinking about this, if I have an indexed payment, my inclination is to say, okay, at least when the index pops in, I know I have that payment for the remainder of the contract. I need to do some bookkeeping there. But if I have the ability to turn right around and charge that index to customers, as I would in a service concession, it seems to me that I ought to think real hard about crediting the entire or debiting the entire adjustment to the liability to expense when I have the ability to recover.
I come in?
Yeah.
If we say, for instance, that CPI falls into AG7, my understanding, but I may be wrong, is that effectively you are going to project using the current CPI, but discount using also the CPI. So the effect is good. And you remeasure each time there is a refixing using the new data. So there is an effect, as written in the paper, under for how you apply AG7, almost no effect for changes into the liability. But you have, you acknowledge that you're going to make those payments over, say, 20 years. So,
if you apply AG7, and in many cases you would alter the effective interest rate, so in that case there would be no adjustment to the liability or very small adjustment to the liability. But maybe Wayne was pointing to some situations where the entity does not apply AG7 in that case. And in that case, if the entity applies AG8, the effective interest rate is not altered, and then you would have some, you would use the original effective interest rate as mentioned in IAS 39, and in that case you would have adjustment to the liability, and in that case you might consider that in service concession arrangements as described by Wayne, you should capitalize.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's because we're not talking about the same thing. I didn't have the CPI example in my head anymore when I was talking about paragraph 60.
Scott?
I appreciate that we're trying to decouple, but I'm having trouble thinking about it, because in order for me to figure out what to do with the remeasurement, I need to know what was considered in the initial measurement. For example, on the indexing, if we've got an indexed payment and we initially recorded the liability based on the spot rate, then I feel differently about how I book changes than I do if we booked it initially using the forward rates. So, because the forward rate seems like we already looked ahead when we booked it initially. So I think there we were trying to be done initially and not affect the cost in the future. Whereas if we booked the spot rate, we, you know, always knew that we weren't booking the all-in cost. So I understand there are some who would like to decouple this and we only want to talk about the remeasurement. I'm not feeling like I can come up with an answer on remeasurement without knowing about the initial measurement.
Guido? There we go.
I'm in favor of alternative B, and I think if I understood the alternative correctly, the staff is giving an answer to this decoupling or initial measurement, because my understanding is that alternative B says that when the adjustment is a change of estimate, then it would be not part of the initial recognition. So you would either say I can't measure it reliably or not, and if it's a change in estimate, it would go to acquisition cost. If I could initially measure it, then you would say, well, part of the changes of the liability is interest expense for the time value of money, which I agree with, and that goes through P&L, and the rest of it is part of the acquisition cost. So my understanding is that you're giving the answer, alternative B, already for both cases, where you measure it initially or where you don't, because either you say, well, the standard is not clear, or I cannot measure it reliably. And I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think that IAS 32 does not prohibit this. As I said, there are a lot of people out there that say AG8 tells you, or AG7 to a certain extent tells you, that everything goes through P&L. I do not think that this is correct. It's an application guidance of IAS 32, and other standards like 23 tell you no. these interest expense or the changes in the liability might be part of the acquisition cost. So I'm firmly in alternative B, and I do not think, coming back to what Andrew said, but maybe I didn't understand you correctly, that the question whether it's part of the acquisition cost, the changes in the liability, should be dependent on the question whether it enhances the value of the asset. Because I think we are not talking about subsequent costs here. My understanding in IS 16 is that for subsequent costs, you would check whether it's enhancing the value, and then you can capitalize it. But from my point of view, it's part of the initial cost. So it's not about whether this payment enhances the value of the asset. Maybe I misunderstood what Andrew said, but if you come up with a paper and say, well, is it part of the acquisition cost, I don't think that the decision should be dependent on whether it enhances the value or the benefits that are included in the asset. It's just part of the initial cost.
Luca, and then John.
In general, I'm in line with the preference expressed by the staff, even though also considering the discussion of today, I think that's probably... if the staff could prepare some examples just to be sure that we have exactly the same concept and the same understanding of the application, because I would like to be sure that the cases in which we are putting inside AG7 rather than those included in AG8 could be a bit different according to the interpretation. So if you, I think that could be useful to have some examples, just or even considering those in paragraph 7, and to verify which is the application considering the results of this analysis.
John?
Yeah, I favor alternative B, but I would like to see examples. And I suppose I'd like to see examples which start from a no recognition of the liability, a recognition of the liability using spot rate, and a recognition of liability using the forward rate, which Scott referred to just sort of tease out our thinking about what the subsequent measurement, remeasurement or initial measurement of that liability in subsequent periods really represents. Whether we think it's, yeah, I think those examples would help us, or certainly help me determine whether capitalization to, or recognition as part of the cost of the asset is appropriate.
Yeah, take your point, and I think we can have the staff do that. I'm not convinced it matters, but it's worth teasing it out. You're right. Charlotte, then I think we're close to wrapping up.
I'm generally in support of view B. For me, if everything was included in the initial estimate, then it would all fall into that first subset that any change the estimate. My only concern is that the point that Scott raised, I think, on payments that depend on an index. Because the way it's written then is that LIBOR would be included as an estimate in your initial cost. Then any changes in LIBOR or estimates of LIBOR, what would go through the asset cost? Well, it would seem logically that they should be an interest payment.
No, because LIBOR is a floating rate instrument, so you would apply AG7.
But you said that was included. It's included in the estimate. Maybe it's just if you have some examples would help.
In the case of LIBOR, you would apply AG7. There's no question about it.
Right.
It's a floating rate instrument. So in that case, you wouldn't not, well, in many cases, you wouldn't have any adjustment to the liability because you change the effective interest rate when applying AG7.
So I guess for me, there's certain estimates that you then apply AG7 to. It's distinguishing between which estimate is which kind.
Okay, Baylong and Jean, excuse me.
I prefer alternative 2 rather than alternative 1, but I'm not still convinced by the conclusion on the subsequent accounting. I think it would be helpful if we make an assessment, agent principal assessment on the IS 18, the gross and net presentation. It could be helpful.
Okay. What I'm hearing before Jean comes in is a lot of what one of my mentors used to say, if you like the answer, you're going to love the theory. Jean?
I'm also in favor of alternative B, but to come back on Lauren's point regarding subsequent remeasurement, or I think we're dealing with remeasurement of a liability upon initial recognition. So I think we should avoid, if it's a revision of estimate or not, if there is a liability or not. I think I would think that if there is no liability initially recognized, then it's not part of the cost. Or maybe we're bringing something that is quite confusing with trying to finesse with whether there was it's a revision of an estimate or not. I think the liability ought, if it's part of the cost, the liability ought to be there when I buy the asset, I guess. Maybe I'm simplistic, but and then this liability may be measured at zero, or maybe. So I would go straight with remeasurement of a liability that relates to the acquisition of the asset and whether or not that's capitalizable or not.
Okay, I hear a consensus around the second view for a variety of different reasons, but we need to take a look at some examples. And those examples ought to go back to what we did at initial recognition and take a specific look at whether or not we think that matters. I take Scott's point, and I think John's too, that it might matter, it might affect your thinking. So let's do it that way. Okay. We done on this one? Lawrence and Andrew?
Just one last thing about amendment to IFRIC 12. I wasn't sure to understand what you are proposing in paragraph 73 and 74. So if I understand correctly, the timing would be that you would propose amendments to IFRIC 12 at the same time of re-exposure of the lease? Is that it?
That's what the board, what the committee decided when discussing about the IFRIC 12 amendments.
Yeah. Andrew?
Similar point, maybe I can't, because I can't recall those discussions, but can we make the IFRIC 12 amendment without resolving this issue?
Yeah,
didn't understand. I thought they were all wrapped up.
The paragraphs is particularly to emphasize that we think that even if the committee cannot reach a consensus on what we are discussing today about variable payments, we should proceed with the amendments to IFRIC 12 that were previously decided by the committee.
Okay. I think strictly that's true. But it would seem to me that we all ought to have a little pause about saying, well, we've addressed the liability, but you're on your own on the debit. And I think that's why we linked these two in the first place.
Yes.
But I think we're worrying about things before we have to. So, John, last comment.
Just on the IFRIC 12, I'd support moving forward because the committee previously did agree on fixed payments and service concessions, how they should be accounted for. And I think there is a need for clarity on those. I think it can be dealt with independently of variable payment, the variable payments issue.
Okay, now it's really last call.
Just to say that I disagree with the last comment of John, I do believe that in service concession arrangements, you usually have fixed payments and variable payments. So you should not look at just one element without looking at the other elements. So I do support looking at the two comprehensively.
Okay. Let's move on then to employee benefits. John?